Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Chicago Tonight Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. It was Memorial Day 5 years ago that video captured the murder of George Floyd at the knee of a Minneapolis police officer. Floyd's death, just a couple of months into the start of a global pandemic, ignited a racial reckoning, sparking demonstrations nationwide and calls for police accountability. Tonight, we'll explore what's changed in the 5 years since his death and what advocates say remains to be done. It was a video seen around the world. 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Enough time to end the life of George Floyd and change the lives of those around him. Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck as he was handcuffed on the ground.
What do you want?
I can breathe.
That video capturing Floyd's last moments, sparking outrage and protests across the country.
Stop killing us! Stop killing us!
Especially in communities that have a long history with police brutality.
The video brought back that trauma of Laquan McDonald's death.
Frustrations boiled over and some demonstrations turned violent, damaging businesses downtown and across Chicago's neighborhoods. Governor J.B. Pritzker deployed the National Guard at Mayor Lori Lightfoot's request, who also declared a citywide curfew for the first time since 1968.
I do understand the anger, the frustration that have plagued across our country, even our city of Chicago. However, I don't think that this is the answer to solve anything right about now.
Repeated violent clashes between Chicago police and protesters occurred throughout the summer. Reports later found the city and CPD were, quote, unprepared for the protests and ensuing unrest. And taxpayers have paid for it, spending $8.7 million to defend and settle lawsuits related to officer misconduct during the 2020 protests. Protesters continue to hit the streets, pushing for police reform. The Black Lives Matter movement and calls to defund the police gain traction. And in 2021, Derek Chauvin was convicted and sentenced to 22 years in prison.
Real justice would be, Silky, that George Floyd would still be here with his family. So what we got today was some measure of accountability.
With that conviction, all eyes turned to Congress and the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. But the federal legislation that would ban the use of chokeholds and qualified immunity for officers and create a national police misconduct registry, among other actions, has been stalled in the U.S. Senate.
If you can make federal laws to protect the bird, which is the bald eagle, you can make federal laws to protect people of color.
Meanwhile, Illinois passed a sweeping police reform bill into law that, in part, requires law enforcement to wear body cameras and creates a certification program for police.
This moment is a hopeful moment.
And in Chicago, Floyd's murder focused new attention on the police department's lack of progress in complying with a federal court order requiring it to stop routinely violating the civil rights of Black and Latino residents. And a new era of oversight began in 2023 with the first election of the Community Commission for Public Safety and Accountability, designed to give Chicagoans a real say in how the department operates. But activists say police shootings since Floyd's murder, like Sonya Massey, Jacob Blake, and Dante Wright, are evidence that more needs to be done. And since the murder of George Floyd, some police departments across the country have made changes. But many of those actions are now threatened under the Trump administration. The Department of Justice just today announcing that it would end federal oversight of police departments in Minneapolis and Louisville and plans to close investigations in other cities. Despite the order, Chicago's consent decree mandating police reform will remain in effect because it does not involve the DOJ. Joining us to discuss all of this, some more, are Bradley Johnson, the chief community officer from Build Chicago, Ernest Cato, a retired Chicago police chief who served more than 30 years on the force, and on Zoom, Craig Futterman, a University of Chicago law professor, and Kofi Adimola, founder of Good Kids Mad City. We also invited the Chicago Police Department to join us, but they declined. Gentlemen, thanks to all of you for joining us. Kofi Adimola, I want to start with you, please. In the nearly 5 years since George Floyd's death, public discourse about police brutality and anti-Black racism,
It's died down a good bit outside of activist circles. What would you say is happening right now among activists and grassroots circles since the spotlight has sort of moved away from these issues?
Sure. First and foremost, thank you for having me. I would say locally here in Chicago, we have what's called the Chicago Torture Justice Center. And it's a place where survivors of police torture originally from John Byrd, but we can also go all the way up to Homan Square, where survivors are being supported. So having more resources for things like that, the young people of Good Kids, Mad City, they're advocating to pass the Peace Book, which is a public safety initiative for violence prevention to give resources for young people to push peace. So on that end, you know, along with the Alliance's work, like you said, we're seeing some progress, right? But on the other end, we still have Dexter Reed, who was shot over 90 times here in Chicago. And we see Chicago Police Department's budget going up every year to where it's over $2 billion now. And that's not even accounting for the amount of money that's being paid out for police misconduct and police violence, which I believe we've already hit the $82 million mark this year so far. So there's still a lot of ways to go and a lot of work to still be done.
Right. And just today, City Council approved several million dollars more in police misconduct lawsuit settlements. Kofi, you know, back in the summer of 2020, hundreds, thousands of people who maybe weren't typically protesting filled the streets, right? Joining people who are always demonstrating and protesting. Do you think that, you know, the folks who aren't necessarily directly involved, as you and the Chicago Torture Justice Center and Good Kids Mad City are, do you think those folks who aren't involved have sort of moved away from the conversation or have gone back to their lives in those 5 years?
No, I don't think so. I think when we see even with people marching against Trump, folks marching in solidarity with Palestine, you know, these are some of the same communities and same organizers that get impacted by police violence. One thing I will say, though, is both the Democrats and Republicans, both liberals and conservatives, did a pretty good job of being anti-defund the police, right? So you saw messaging coming from the Biden administration, and you saw messaging coming from the Trump administration, and then Democrats and Republicans from the Senate on down to local elections were very adamant about being pro-police and about making sure that police are fully funded. So I would say that's probably the biggest backlash, and a lot of the propaganda that you saw on television, commercials, et cetera, media really propagating that. So I think that did turn a lot of people off from the movement. Because one, they just assumed if you send a cop to jail for murdering a black person, that's justice, which we believe it's not. And that, you know, police getting more money to supposedly keep our community safe, we don't believe that's justice either. We believe we need to be invested in healing, restorative justice, and other things to make our community safe.
And we do have a former police officer joining us, a former police chief. Ernest Cato, you were, you know, still active in law enforcement, of course, in 2020. How did you feel at the time? What was it like for you to be in the position that you were in 2020 as a black man?
That's always been a difficult position to be in as a black man, especially coming from the community that I did come from. But having an understanding of communities that have been, have not pretty much felt like they had a fair treatment, and then being in a position where I had to actually also provide some form of law enforcement, it's a tricky position, but my life prepared me for it. So I had an idea of what folks may have felt like in from the community that I came from, but also knew that I had a job to do. The difficult part was trying to bring them both together and understand and make the community understand that we had a job to do, but at the same time, those who worked for me, I had to make them have an understanding of how the community felt. And the area that I worked in, we pretty much led that way on the west side of Chicago, pretty much having an understanding how the community felt, but understanding also we had to protect property and lives.
So a fine line walk for you.
It was a tightrope. It was a tightrope. Sometimes I may have went home and I just had to understand my purpose. What was my purpose? And my purpose was, again, to defend lives, protect property, but also have empathy with the community.
Bradley Johnson, tell us about the work that Bill does to foster a positive police-community relationship.
Yeah, so, you know, Bill, as a youth development organization, you know, since 1969, we've worked tirelessly to make sure that there's a relationship where we communicate regularly with police officers, with the police department. We stand in a gap with our young people saying that if there's an issue, bring them to us, and we'll, you know, help to work with them. I think that we also have worked to partner with the police department to get feedback and hear the voices of community, hear the voices of our young people, the people impacted by some of the policies and the practices, so that there's a face put to how policing happens. And then also to humanize. You know, I sit on one of the advisory boards for the training academy for the police department, where myself, along with other leaders and nonprofits across the city, we actually get to review the annual trainings that police officers get, and where we're able to get feedback. And that feedback tends to be where, on the police side, I know they talk about constitutionality of their work, and also there is this this focus on making sure, you know, in a way, you know, in a shorter way, not to get in trouble, that there won't be, you know, lawsuits.
And I was just going to mention, I know that you also do some work with young people on how to interact with young people.
Exactly.
And how to interact with the police, excuse me.
Yeah, so we do a lot of Know Your Rights. We teach young people really how do you actually respond to officers when they speak to you. Be courteous and listen, but also know what your rights are, but also how do you actually remain safe so you don't escalate the situation. So that's really important. And the reason why is because sometimes with our young people, with their history and with the history that they picked up, they meet officers with aggression. Sometimes officers meet them with aggression, and they push it right back. But the power dynamics aren't even.
Okay. Professor Futterman, I want to get you in here because you founded the Civil Rights and Police Accountability Clinic in 2000, which in part seeks to improve accountability within CPD. What progress have you seen since you've started this work?
Like Kofi, I'd say we've seen real progress, but it's been far too slow. Got a long way to go. Particularly areas where we've seen the most progress is areas where people have stood up, where people in the community have intervened and forced the police to engage. One of the areas, first time in ever, not just in my lifetime, that the agency that investigates police abuse in Chicago has actually ever sought to hold officers accountable when they abuse their powers to hurt people. And that's COPA, which is also under assault at this moment. Transparency. One of the things that we've seen in major progress is we want a lawsuit with folks side by side with the community that makes police misconduct records. All complaints of police misconduct records belong to the people, that police have to release video when officers kill someone. Along with Chief Cato, we fundamentally transformed the rules governing police use of force, violence, with an emphasis on sanctity of life for all people. De-escalating situations, using force only when necessary, dramatically reduced the number of violent, wrongful home raids targeting Black and Brown families. And all this has led to a real decrease, and this matters. Police in Chicago have killed less people now than just 10 years ago, when it was basically like a weekly basis at the time when Officer Van Dyke shot those 16 shots mostly into the back of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. But we still have
as you said, Professor, it sounds like there's still more work to be done. I wish we had more time to discuss it all with the four of you, but that's where we'll have to leave it. My thanks to Bradley Johnson, Ernest Cato, Craig Futterman, and Kofi Adeemola. Thank you all. Up next, promises made, promises broken by businesses and consumers in the wake of George Floyd's murder.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
When Danielle Moore opened Semicolon Books in 2019, business was slow. Until the social justice movement after Floyd's death launched her store into the spotlight as black businesses and books gained national attention. But looking back, Moore says that moment was short-lived, and many black-owned bookstores, including her own, are facing challenges with little support.
There's not one black bookseller who will tell you that we didn't know that this is a passing fad. Whole companies are ordering 1,000 of these books that nobody's going to read because they don't care enough. They would place the order for these books and pay for them and never pick them up. They had no intention of actually doing the work. They would just screenshot the receipt and put it on their social media to show that they did it. We still have these books from 2020 in our stores right now that customers have not picked up. Of, you know, the 100,000 new customers that we gained, we've retained about 15,000 of those. While it felt good to finally feel like we could breathe a sigh of relief, we could make all of our bills this month, we could give more away in our community this month, it was also just waiting on that other shoe to drop. You can't count on fads or moments going viral or anything like that to actually sustain a business model. It's important that people genuinely consider the plight of entrepreneurship in the black community and what it comes with. We recognize that at any point we may not exist here anymore because we choose to do the work of community. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of people who give to community in that way.
Moore also closed her Westtown shop permanently in January because of financial struggles. But after raising over $30,000 through a Kickstarter campaign, she's reopening it on Juneteenth with an added cafe. In the 2 years after George Floyd's murder, nearly 1,400 Fortune 1000 companies pledged a total of $340 billion towards fighting racial injustice. That's from an analysis by the McKinsey Institute for Black and Economic Mobility in 2023. 40% of companies made statements in support of racial justice. 30% made external commitments to promote racial equity in economic opportunities. But today, dozens and dozens of companies are dropping those three words, those three letters, from the initiatives they launched so loudly 5 years ago. Here with more on this are Reverend Waltrina Middleton, Executive Director of Community Renewal Society, and on Zoom, Xavier Ramey, Chief Executive Officer of Justice Informed, and Mark Morial, President of the National Urban League. Welcome back to all of you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Xavier Ramey, let's start with you. What was at the core of those DEI, those diversity, equity, and inclusion pledges 5 years ago?
Well, it was the desire to be on the right side of history in a way that would support the people that companies were trying to hire all along, as well as ensure that it propped up the brand. I think a lot of what the intentions were around the financial dollars that were being spent and committed by companies was to show that they were invested in the way that we expect them to be, which is we understand that companies have cash. And they were committing that cash towards it. The challenge was that the commitments were not backed by real strategy, and they certainly weren't backed by real accountability that was both community-informed and community-accountable. They were accountable to themselves and their shareholders, and as soon as the market turned, so did their commitments.
Reverend Middleton, what are the corporations saying then? What's the message when they abandon the DEI efforts, as they have, whether it was quietly before Trump issued his executive order or since then?
Well, I think a fellow panelist said it well. I think it speaks to just how superficial some of these commitments are. If you are genuinely committed to your customers, then you will be committed and faithful to them no matter how the tides turn. And I think that especially during the pandemic, many people were faithful to, let's say, a Target or what have you. And so to have these organizations to turn their back on communities now more than ever, where there's dire socioeconomic needs, is quite disappointing.
Mark Morial, the National Urban League, you all released a report just last week examining the way government institutions, advocates, and businesses respond to racial injustice. The subtitle of your report asks, was it a moment or a movement? What would you say it was? Uh-oh, I think you're on mute, sir.
I said, thank you for having me. For too many, it was a moment. And many of us are still fighting to ensure that the legacy of George Floyd remains a movement. But this is not happening in a vacuum. It is under vociferous attack. And that, those attacks began before the election of the 47th president, began several years ago with really a concerted campaign to undermine the commitments that had been made, the financial commitments, the commitments to racial justice. What we found is, I find that there are three camps here. There's those that have walked away completely. There are those that have maintained their commitment. Many of them are operating quietly and under the radar. And then there are those who put lipstick on a pig, or they put lipstick on a beautiful, beautiful pig, in the sense that they're making cosmetic changes, purging their websites, changing their language, dropping the use of the term diversity, equity, and inclusion. What I want everyone to understand here, when you poll diversity, equity, and inclusion, when you ask questions of the American people about their commitment, on the low end, if you just use the term DE&I, it's 50-50. On the high end, if you talk about commitment to diversity, commitment to racial justice, commitment to fairness, the numbers are up at 70, almost 80. The voices in opposition to this are loud, they're financially strong, and they have political power. They do not represent the majority voices in this country. So this moment is distressing, it's disappointing, and my greatest concern at the moment of George Floyd, when all of these commitments emerged, was that there would come a time when people would back away, go soft, or lose their enthusiasm for these commitments. Now, the community has reacted in some cases with selective buying, selective purchasing. It's an example of the reaction and the really hard feelings that many of us have. As someone of a generation that had an opportunity because of civil rights, because of struggle, because of lawsuits, because of protests, because of advocacy, to walk through those doors and do this work, I'm greatly distressed by what I see.
Sorry, thank you, Mark Morial, because I wanted to jump in with another thing that we hear the Trump administration using a lot. The attack on DEI has also, it's villainized the term woke. That before, maybe 5 years ago, not everybody even understood what it meant. Reverend Middleton, remind us what the word woke means, what it's intended to mean.
Yes, I mean, the word woke was a term that appeared in the 1930s to help to raise consciousness, to make sure that community members were cognizant of issues that impacted them directly, either socioeconomic impact, and especially as it pertains to race. And I think that to criminalize or to make it seem as if folks who are aware, who are conscious about how things are unfolding in their community is a negative thing, really shows a level of ignorance and a lack of awareness itself. Being woke is a positive term because it shows that you care enough about your community and your neighbors to want to be vested and to make sure that you have all of the resources and information possible so that you could be a part of positive change in your community.
Before we run out of time, really quickly, should this term be reclaimed or abandoned now that it's been hijacked this way?
Absolutely. And I don't think it was ever abandoned by the community who gave birth to the terminology. I think people are unapologetic in being woke. And I think that the fact that you have a community that tries to demonize the term says that they are afraid of community being conscious, that there's a fear of knowledge.
Xavier, we've got 1 minute left. What do you think are white individuals' responsibility in the wake of George Floyd?
To make sure that he didn't die in vain. George Floyd died because of white supremacy. He died because of the American tradition of policing. He died because of rampant ignorance and an assumption that Dr. King somehow finished all of the work through his sacrifice. There is real and present work that African Americans, brown folks, Asian folks, and white folks all need to do. But particularly white Americans, there is a different work that I hope that they invite themselves to consider. And that work includes understanding how their privileges create the necessity and the reality of George Floyd's being killed. How and why it is that currently they're taking up the most levels of wealth and space and jobs in some of the biggest companies that America has to offer, and people of color are still fighting just to even be considered with their resumes. There's a reason behind this, and I think specifically white Americans in this moment, 5 years after the murder of George Floyd, need to think about, one, what does it mean to be white in America? Not just how do we do racial equity. What does it mean to be white, and how do I use that privilege to actually change what it means to be black?
Some of the same conversations we had about 5 years ago with some of the same folks who are on this panel right now. That's where we'll have to leave it. My thanks to Reverend Dr. Waltrina Middleton, Xavier Ramey, and Mark Morial. Thank you all again.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm that supports educational initiatives in the legal profession.